Seit mehr als 155 Jahren begleitet die Commerzbank Kundinnen und Kunden bei wichtigen finanziellen Entscheidungen. Ob sie ihr Unternehmen weiterentwickeln, ihr Vermögen strukturieren oder ihre finanzielle Zukunft planen. Gemeinsam machen wir aus ihren Ideen, Plänen und Anliegen echte Erfolgsgeschichten. Erfolg, der auf unserer langjährigen Expertise und einer vertrauensvollen Partnerschaft basiert. Erfolgsgeschichten beginnen bei der Commerzbank. Wann sprechen wir über Ihre? Mehr Infos unter commerzbank.de/Erfolgsgeschichten.
Hi, this is Sherelle Dorsey from TED Tech, and this episode is brought to you by Solidigm. The world runs on data, and data relies on storage. But most businesses rarely think about how crucial that storage really is. The truth is, it's no longer just a commodity. With new demands and constraints, especially from AI, the old ways of managing data are holding innovation back. Solid-state storage from Solidigm is changing that. It helps reduce energy use, shrink physical footprints, and accelerate data at the edge, unlocking more from your AI infrastructure. Learn more at whatsthestateofyourstorage.com.
Canadian True Crime is a completely independent production, funded mainly through advertising. You can listen to Canadian True Crime ad-free and early on Amazon Music, included with Prime, Apple Podcasts, Patreon, and Supercast. The podcast often has disturbing content and coarse language. It's not for everyone. Please take care when listening.
Where we left off, the Canadian Bandidos were in serious trouble with US headquarters in Texas. After the Bandidos had been decimated in the Quebec Biker Wars, Wayne Callestine's scrappy motorcycle club had patched over to form the only Bandidos chapter left in Canada, the Toronto chapter. A series of mishaps had led to his relatively inexperienced mentee, John Boxer Mouchedre, being appointed national president of the Bandidos in Canada. Boxer was only in it for the brotherhood, but Wayne wanted the power, and he was now seething that Boxer outranked him. After Wayne was released from his latest prison stint, he met Michael Taz Sandom, who led the new probationary Bandidos chapter in Winnipeg, Manitoba. And Michael was frustrated because Boxer Mouchedre would not take his chapter off probation. Wayne Callestine saw an opportunity to drive a wedge and grab some power back for himself. He met with Michael Sandom privately and promised to help his Winnipeg chapter become fully patched-in members. They also started talking about future plans to expand the Bandidos again across Canada, independent of National President Boxer Mouchedre. But months elapsed and there were still no patches for Winnipeg. Michael Taz Sandom decided to email US Bandidos headquarters directly to complain about Boxer's leadership. But they had no idea who he was, or that there even was a Winnipeg probationary chapter. It was the last straw. Texas had not been happy with Boxer either, or any of the Canadian Bandidos. Over the past year, they'd repeatedly asked for updates and requested more regular contact. But Canada was not following the rules. Texas sent another email, more tersely worded than the last. It read in part, quote, "It has been decided that due to lack of participation, Canada's charter is being pulled, effective immediately. Return all Bandido patches and property. In approximately 30 days, we will make notification to all that we no longer have a chapter in Canada and that any person wearing our patch in Canada is not sanctioned." Treasurer Luis Chopper Raposo received the email. He was becoming increasingly disillusioned with John Boxer Mouchedre's leadership as Canadian National President. So this time he went to Wayne Callestine for advice. What he didn't know was that Wayne had been conspiring with Michael Sandom in Winnipeg, and with this contact, he'd provided fuel for it. At around this time, Michael Sandom told Wayne Callestine that he'd heard a rumour that the Toronto Bandidos were in talks with the Outlaws to patch over without him. Wayne was furious. Even though he himself had been secretly colluding with the Winnipeg crew, he felt especially betrayed by his old friend and former protege, Boxer Mouchedre. Wayne knew that the outlaws would never accept him, and he thought it must be only a matter of time before Texas realized that he was the man to run the Canadian Bandidos. But if Toronto patched over to the outlaws, he'd have almost nothing to be president of. The rumor wasn't true. Boxer and the Toronto crew were desperate to stay under the Bandidos' banner. And realistically, why would the outlaws want to patch over a struggling chapter of Bandidos that weren't serious bikers and made no money? That would be a liability. Later, the police would come to realize that the rumor had actually been started by Michael Sandham himself to provoke an emotional reaction from Wayne Callestine, one of his ruthless manipulation tactics. The Toronto Bandidos started calling themselves the No Surrender Crew. They would not return their patches. They were not going to leave. They were going to convince US headquarters to let them stay. Toronto President Frank Bam Bam Salerno finally sent a reply to Texas. He said he was feeling confused, dejected, and emotionally drained. He reminded them that he'd been with the Bandidos for years, through thick and thin, as rival clubs tried everything in their power to shut them down. Quote, "But we stood tall and wore our colours proud. Being a Bandido in good standing is my world. Quite frankly, I resent having to go through this. I have always done the nation proud." But Bam Bam Salerno didn't address the fact that the problem existed because of his own chapter's failure to meet several membership requirements. He didn't offer to finally right those wrongs. It was a purely emotional plea. The Bandido secretary in Texas wrote back, saying only the world leader of Bandido Nation had any power in the situation, but he'd check in and see if there was anything that could be done. John Boxer Mouchedre was taking the situation very badly. He decided to fire off a defiant email of his own to the secretary, pointing out that the lack of communication between Canada and the US was a two-way street, and the American Bandidos hadn't bothered to come to Canada either. They'd missed important events, including weddings and funerals. Boxer then started emailing various Bandido chapters around the world, asking for support, writing, quote, "Are we a dictatorship or a brotherhood? What have we become? We would like a worldwide vote from all our brothers before we return our Bandido properties. Cut one, we all bleed. I have been slashed. The No Surrender Crew will never surrender." Boxer asked all the chapters to vote for the Toronto chapter to stay. It was a direct challenge to US leadership, and very unprecedented. Jeff Pike, the world leader of Bandido Nation, entered the chat. Quote, "Bandidos don't vote. They do what the fuck they're told." Texas was becoming irate with Toronto's insubordination. The No Surrender Crew decided they better send someone to Texas and chose George Crash Kriarakis, the tow truck driver. He had no criminal record and wasn't a violent or unpredictable person. By this point, it had been about 7 months since Crash got married. His wife Diane had still been trying to convince him to leave the Bandidos, and he was seriously considering it, but he still had a deep sense of loyalty to his clubmates. Crash had a very decent meeting with Texas. He was greatly surprised when he was informed he'd been appointed the new national president of the Bandidos Canada. But when Crash returned to Toronto, Boxer Mouchedre continued to act as though nothing had changed. Crash did too. So for all intents and purposes, Boxer remained the national president. The No Surrender Crew was not going anywhere. Over in Winnipeg, Michael Taz Sandham was continuing to email US Bandido headquarters directly, still going over Box's head. His most recent email was to let them know he'd just heard that the Toronto chapter had been asked to return their patches, and he wanted to make sure the US knew that Winnipeg was a separate entity. He wrote, "The day that I became part of this family was a great honour to me and my crew. We've worked very hard out here for about a year and a half. I hope this will not reflect on us." Michael urged Texas to contact himself or Wayne Callestine directly if there were any concerns. The conversation turned into a planned meetup between Canada and the US. They arranged to meet at Peace Arch Park, located on the Canada-US border near Vancouver. The park allows visitors to explore both the Canadian and American sides without formally crossing the border. This was a very good solution for outlaw bikers who often had criminal records. Of course, the park is monitored by Border Patrol and law enforcement on both sides, so they had to behave. Michael Sandham and Wayne Callestine showed up and were soon joined by a senior US bandido named Peter Mongo Price. He told them that Bandido Nation was furious that the Toronto chapter was still wearing Bandido patches. And what was with this no surrender crew stuff? It was time for an ultimatum. If Wayne Callestine got those patches back, Texas would promote him to national leader of the Canadian Bandidos, and he would be allowed to start up his own Bandidos chapter in London, Ontario, closer to where he lived. These things were exactly what Wayne had always wanted. He was elated. Texas also promised that upon pulling those patches, Michael Taz Sandham would become the Bandidos' national secretary, with full membership and patches granted to his Winnipeg chapter. But there was a catch. If they failed to pull the patches of the Toronto chapter, their own patches would be pulled. Both Wayne and Michael agreed to take on the challenge. At around this time, a biker associate of Michael Taz Sandham and the Winnipeg Bandidos from Saskatchewan was on an online forum where outlaw motorcycle club members went to communicate with each other. He saw a random comment that took him aback. A biker who identified themselves as being with the Outlaws Motorcycle Club in Canada mentioned that Michael Sandham had originally tried to join that club, but they rejected him because he was a cop. The associate immediately called Dwight Mushy, the 39-year-old co-owner of a seedy Winnipeg nightclub who had a black belt in Taekwondo and was believed to have once worked for a prominent mafia family in Montreal. He was also considered second in charge of the Winnipeg chapter, a hulk of a man who stood at 6'3", towering over chapter president Michael Sandham. Dwight Mushy had a reputation for being polite but frightening if you crossed him. He'd been convicted of selling meth in Winnipeg. When Dwight was told about the rumours suggesting Michael Sandham might have been a police officer, he checked out the comments himself and said he wasn't worried. Michael had already been cleared by the Toronto Bandidos via Wayne Callestine's own security company. But they decided to ask him directly at the next Winnipeg church meeting. Michael laughed it off as a rumour, saying that people probably had their wires crossed because of his background. He'd served in the army, he was a sharpshooter, and after that, he'd been employed for a time to teach self-defence to groups that sometimes included law enforcement. The rumours were probably just related to that. A few weeks later, Michael received an email from US headquarters in Texas asking for an update on the patches. The Toronto chapter had been expelled, and returning those patches was an important symbolic gesture. So why hadn't Wayne Callestine done it yet? Michael didn't actually know why Wayne was stalling, but he said he was going to find out. He announced to his Winnipeg crew that they were going to make the long trip back to Wayne's farm in southwestern Ontario to help him pull the patches of the No Surrender crew. He told them that this was on orders from Bandido headquarters in Texas, but warned them not to tell Wayne. They were just going to show up, surprise Wayne, and offer their help. Of course, Michael Sandham had no idea how they were actually going to pull those patches, but they would figure that part of it out once they got there. But after just a few hours on the road, the trip was cut short. Michael Taz Sandham got a call from his common law wife in Winnipeg. She told him that a couple of Toronto bandidos had randomly shown up at her parents' home, believing that's where he lived. She said they asked to speak to Michael Sandham and they weren't friendly about it. Michael immediately knew that something was wrong and the crew turned back to Winnipeg. The police would later uncover evidence that it was a planned hit. Some of the Toronto bandidos had enough of Michael Taz Sandham. The man had always been affable and eager to please, obviously angling for their approval so his probation would be lifted and the Winnipeg crew would finally be patched in as full Bandidos members. But Michael's demeanour had recently changed. The Toronto Bandidos noticed he'd suddenly become dismissive of them and communicated with a distinct air of smugness. At one point, Treasurer Luis Chopper Raposo wrote him a tense email after struggling to get hold of anyone from the Winnipeg chapter. Chopper wrote, "I need contact with everyone there at least once a week." Michael replied, "I'm not available. Stop calling the brothers' homes and families." This reply angered Chopper so much he printed it out. But behind the scenes, there was, of course, a reason for Michael Sandham's sudden about-face. He was feeling cocky after the meeting with Texas at Peace Arch Park. He knew the No Surrender crew was all but done. All that was left to do was pull their patches. Soon, he'd be the national secretary of the Bandidos. And Michael Taz Sandham did not have to answer to anyone in Toronto. Certainly not Treasurer Chopper Raposo, who had accused him repeatedly of not paying his dues. But of course, Chopper and the No Surrender crew had no idea about the secret meeting with Texas. All they knew was that Michael Sandham was suddenly being a pain. He had to go. Toronto chapter president Frank Bam Bam Salerno made the call. He sent two outsider bandidos to Winnipeg to kill him, promising to install one of them as president of the Winnipeg chapter afterwards. He'd given them Michael Sandham's address, the address he provided when he first joined the bandidos. Problem was, he didn't actually live there. It was the address of his in-laws. So after the failed hit, the two bandidos rode back to Ontario with their tails between their legs. But the order to hit Michael Taz Sandham remained. They'd have to come up with something else.
Seit mehr als 155 Jahren begleitet die Commerzbank Kundinnen und Kunden bei wichtigen finanziellen Entscheidungen. Ob sie ihr Unternehmen weiterentwickeln, ihr Vermögen strukturieren oder ihre finanzielle Zukunft planen. Gemeinsam machen wir aus ihren Ideen, Plänen und Anliegen echte Erfolgsgeschichten. Erfolg, der auf unserer langjährigen Expertise und einer vertrauensvollen Partnerschaft basiert. Erfolgsgeschichten beginnen bei der Commerzbank. Wann sprechen wir über Ihre? Mehr Infos unter commerzbank.de/erfolgsgeschichten.
Hi, this is Sherelle Dorsey from TED Tech, and this episode is brought to you by Solidigm. The world runs on data, and data relies on storage. But most businesses rarely think about how crucial that storage really is. The truth is, it's no longer just a commodity. With new demands and constraints, especially from AI, the old ways of managing data are holding innovation back. Solid state storage from Solidigm is changing that. It helps reduce energy use, shrink physical footprints, and accelerate data at the edge, unlocking more from your AI infrastructure. Learn more at whatsthestateofyourstorage.com.
It was now late March of 2006, about a week after the failed hit, and the Winnipeg crew made a second attempt to travel to Wayne Callestine's farm. Accompanying Michael Tazsandam in his car was Dwight Mushy, the imposing nightclub co-owner who could be frightening when crossed. Dwight refused to call him Taz, instead referring to him as Little Beaker after the Muppet for his small stature and high squeaky voice. Dwight wasn't a huge fan of his chapter president, but he was willing to humour him for now. He also brought in two associates from his nightclub. One was Curtis Davidson, a construction worker, bouncer, and father of three. At one stage, Curtis had been the personal bodyguard for several Hell's Angels leaders, but he'd been put under house arrest for selling cocaine with intent to traffic, so he had to stay low for several years. But he was past that now, and Dwight Mushy wanted him to join this new chapter of the Bandidos in Winnipeg. Also in the car was a 22-year-old prospect member named Brett Gardner. As the most junior member of the Winnipeg crew, Brett wasn't known to be a violent person at all, but he was fiercely loyal to the club, despite not owning a motorcycle. Dwight's other friend was Marcelo Aravena, a 30-year-old part-time bouncer at his nightclub. Marcelo was a mixed martial artist and pro boxer originally from Chile, and while he didn't own a motorcycle, he would come in very handy if muscle was needed. Marcelo Aravena wasn't a club prospect, instead considered a friend of the club. And he had a competition to attend that day, so couldn't join the others for the drive. But he'd booked an airfare for the following day and asked them to pick him up from London, Ontario Airport. When the car of bikers driven by Michael Tazsandam arrived at the farm, Wayne Callestine was surprised to see them. Michael shrugged, saying they'd been sent there on orders from US headquarters in Texas. They thought Wayne would know why they'd been sent. Of course, Wayne didn't know about it, but he could guess. Wayne welcomed them all in with open arms and invited them to stay. The following day, they were joined by Marcelo Aravena, fresh from his martial arts competition. And then a friend of Wayne Callestine showed up, a man in his mid-30s with flaming red hair and a swastika tattooed on his neck. His name was Frank Mather, and Wayne knew him from his latest stint in prison. Frank had just been released on parole after being convicted of charges relating to breaking and entering. And while he was known to be a casual supporter of the Bandidos, he wasn't a biker himself or a one percenter. Frank Mather had his pregnant girlfriend with him and they had nowhere to go. Wayne agreed to let them stay if Frank agreed to help him out as a bodyguard. It was a merry time at the Callestine farm with all of the new guests. They went out for dinner at a local restaurant and struggled to rustle up the money to pay. Turns out the Winnipeg crew wasn't making much money either. Then they drove to Chippewas of the Thames First Nation, a nearby Indigenous reserve. Wayne had heard that there was a trailer full of cartons of cigarettes there that they could steal and sell to make some money. But instead, they came across dozens and dozens of frozen pizzas. Unexpected, but helpful. They stole the pizzas and took them back to the farm, where junior members Brett Gardner and Marcelo Aravena were told to start cooking them up. After more than a week spent partying and socialising, the group had to stop stalling and start discussing how they were going to pull the patches of their Toronto chapter brothers. Several options were presented and discussed. At one stage, Wayne suggested only pulling the patches of certain members, the ones he didn't like. That wasn't going to fly, but eventually they settled on a plan. Wayne phoned his old friend Boxer Mouchedre and invited him and the Toronto chapter, the No Surrender Crew, to his farm for a church meeting that Friday. Over in Toronto, John Boxer Mouchedre had started to find himself not feeling the 1% alive as much as he used to, despite his defiant-sounding email to Texas headquarters. By this point, he was engaged to be married, and his fiancée Nina had given birth to a baby daughter. Boxer was content and felt a responsibility to clean himself up. He was working hard to get off drugs and get in shape. He had started boxing again at a local club and was loving it. The boxing club provided the sense of brotherhood he craved, without all the drama and pressure. Boxer was also tired of living in the city of Toronto. He only moved there for the Bandidos, but now that it wasn't working out, he was planning to move his family back to Chatham in southwestern Ontario and get a real job. He, Nina, and the baby were planning to head there on the weekend for a road trip to scope things out. And then he got the call from Wayne Callestine. Boxer wasn't overly enthusiastic about a church meeting at Wayne's farm that Friday night, and he knew the others wouldn't be either. They were the Toronto Bandidos, and Wayne's property was more than 2 hours' drive away. But there were some reasons to attend. Wayne had been keeping a motorcycle at his farm that belonged to a friend of treasurer Luis Chopper Raposo. That friend had just been released from prison and wanted his motorbike back, and Wayne refused for no apparent reason. Boxer decided they would use the church meeting as an opportunity to take it back. He told Wayne they would all be there. The night before the church meeting, Wayne called Boxer again to remind him. This time, he mentioned in passing that Michael, Taz Sandham and the Winnipeg crew were there as well, and they were anxious to speak directly to Boxer and Treasurer Luis Chopper Raposo. Maybe they could finally patch things up. Of course, Wayne Callestine knew that wasn't going to happen. He knew that the Toronto Bandidos had tried and failed to have Michael Sandham killed. Wayne dangled that piece of information as a carrot to make sure the No Surrender crew actually showed up, and then he and the Winnipeg crew would pull all of their patches. They started preparing. Wayne Callestine had been banned from possessing firearms for life, but that didn't stop him from continuing to store them in various caches around his property, from sawn-off pump-action shotguns to standard army service rifles to 9mm handguns. He provided everyone with a selection of firearms. He also made a trip to purchase more ammunition. He told the Winnipeg crew that this was not going to be easy, and Boxer in particular was not going to give up his patch without a fight. They needed to be ready for the worst-case scenario. Wayne told them, quote, "If we kill one, we kill them all." He grabbed what he called his wet work kit, which included hydrochloric acid and rubber gloves, explaining to the Winnipeg crew that he always used this kit to clean up blood after he killed someone. They planned out where everyone would be stationed as the No Surrender crew arrived at the property and walked into the barn where the church meeting would be taking place. They covered the Winnipeg plates on Michael Taz Sandham's car with Ontario plates and hid it on the property out of sight. Wayne Callestine had one last thing to take care of. Despite having a group of unruly bikers and criminals staying at his home for a week, Wayne had a family. He lived on that farm with a common law wife named Tina and their daughter, who was 7 years old. He asked them to go and stay somewhere else until he sent word it was safe for them to return. And the same advice was given to his prison pal Frank Mather's pregnant girlfriend. The next morning was Friday, April 7th of 2006, the day of the church meeting. It was supposed to take place later that evening, and the Toronto Bandidos were dreading it. Technically, the chapter no longer existed, but they'd continued with business as usual. They decided that as well as getting that motorcycle back, they were going to pull Wayne Callestine's patch. It was well past time. That morning, Big Paulie Sinopoli called John Boxer Mouchedre to say that he wasn't going to be able to make it. His stomach ulcer was bleeding and he needed to rest and take his medication. Big Paulie's health had deteriorated as a result of his weight. He had diabetes and heart disease, and Boxer knew that Big Paulie had been planning to take leave from the Bandidos for gastric banding surgery to help him lose weight. Boxer accepted that Big Paulie wasn't going to be able to make it, but told him to contact his Toronto chapter president, Frank Bam Bam Solano, to let him know as well. Bam Bam said no. He told Big Paulie that church meetings are mandatory and he better find a way to be there and bring his money. Bam Bam had no idea exactly what the meeting was about, but assumed it was about unpaid membership dues. Big Paulie reluctantly promised to be there. Later that evening, Bam Bam Solano was at his home in Oakville, preparing to leave for the farm. He phoned one of the two bikers he'd sent up to Winnipeg to deal with Michael Taz Sandham and left a message on the answering machine admonishing them for not doing the job they'd been sent to do. It's not known if Bam Bam was aware that they'd already tried and failed because they had the wrong address, but he told them the mission was still on and to get it done. By this point, Bam Bam had a baby son with his hairdresser wife, and he was trying to get his life together. Stephanie had enrolled him in the Jenny Craig program to lose weight. She really wanted him to leave the Bandidos and leave that life behind. He promised her he'd been pulling back. That night, Bam Bam told her he was leaving to work the night shift at his job washing trucks. He'd see her tomorrow. It was a lie. Bam Bam couldn't bring himself to leave the Toronto Bandidos, not yet anyway. He didn't tell his wife that he was actually on his way to Wayne Callestine's farm for a mandatory church meeting. He said goodbye to Stephanie and their baby son and left. Big Paulie was already on the way in the Infiniti SUV driven by Jamie Goldberg Flans. Goldberg was the recently divorced father of two who ran the successful computer consulting business. The two were close as relatively newer members of the Toronto Bandidos. They'd both joined primarily for friendship and camaraderie. And neither of them knew that undercover surveillance officers from the Ontario Provincial Police were shadowing them as they drove out to Wayne Callestine's farm. It was a surveillance operation that had actually been going on for 4 months in relation to a completely separate issue. In December of 2005, a badly burned body had been found in a field in a Toronto suburb. The body belonged to Sean Douse, a 35-year-old married father of two who worked at a car manufacturer and dealt cocaine on the side. The police investigation uncovered his last known location, and it happened to be the townhouse where Jamie Goldberg Flans lived. Investigators came to believe that Sean Douse was actually killed there and that the Toronto Bandidos were behind it, including Goldberg and Big Paulie. So the Ontario Provincial Police had begun a wiretap operation and put them both under surveillance. In the evening of April 7th, 2006, they shadowed them out to southwestern Ontario as the Infiniti SUV pulled into a service stop and joined up with three other cars, a green tow truck, a silver hatchback, and a dark grey family sedan. Not a motorcycle to be seen. The surveillance team then shadowed them to Wayne Callistine's farm and hung back to find a vantage spot. It was just after 10 p.m. and the cars entered the property out of view. This was just a surveillance job. The police didn't have a warrant to enter the farm. And besides, there was a particularly ferocious-looking German shepherd patrolling the fence. They would wait in the car for another few hours to see if anything happened. Wayne Callistine had been waiting in his barn to greet the No Surrender crew, who were officially late. A circle of white plastic patio chairs had been arranged in the middle of the barn. Hidden in a dark corner of the loft area was Michael Taz Sandham, rifle at the ready. It was his idea. He was a sharp shooter from back in the army days. And the other Winnipeg crew members, Dwight Mushy and Curtis Davidson, were hiding behind the barn with loaded shotguns on the lookout. Wayne's prison pal, Frank Mather, was waiting out there too. They all had rubber gloves on. The two most junior members, prospect Brett Gardner and Marcelo Aravena, were over in the farmhouse. Brett had been charged with monitoring the police scanner. First to walk into the barn was John Boxer Mouchedre, along with Toronto Treasurer Chopper Raposo. Boxer looked around for Michael Sandham, and Wayne said he was at a nearby hotel and might show up later. Chopper Raposo half joked he was going to put a hole in him when he did. The two had been locked in a battle over membership fees. And Chopper had a strange feeling lately. Firearms are not allowed at church meetings, but he'd hidden a sawn-off shotgun in his briefcase just in case. As the No Surrender crew went to sit down in the circle of white plastic chairs, they had no idea that Michael Taz Sandham was looking down on them from the shadows of the loft, holding a rifle, trying hard not to make any noise. Suddenly, a series of gunshots rang out in the barn. The Winnipeg crew rushed in, carrying shotguns, and everyone looked around confused. What just happened? Treasurer Chopper Raposo was lying on the floor, bleeding heavily from his chest and neck area. His fellow clubmates Crash Kriarakis and Big Paul Sinopoli weren't going to hang around to find out. They ran for the door themselves. Wayne Callistine raised his rifle and opened fire on them, and they fell to the floor. He yelled, "Everyone, get on the floor! Nobody move! I'm here to pull your patches!" He told them he was acting on orders from Texas headquarters, and if any of them put up an opposition, they would be taken down. Crash had been shot in the abdomen, and another bullet had grazed Big Paulie's thigh. Wayne scolded them for running away. If they hadn't done that, he wouldn't have needed to shoot them in the first place. He reassured them he'd be taking them for medical treatment soon. Bam Bam Salerno was sitting on the couch, frozen in stunned silence. He had also been grazed on the leg in the gunfire, and little Mikey Trotter had been grazed on his face. By this point, Michael Taz Sandham had made himself known from the rafters. Wayne demanded that someone tell him who it was that made that first shot. Michael said that Chopper started firing at him, and luckily he was saved because he was wearing a bulletproof vest. Chopper wasn't so lucky. The 41-year-old was now dead. He left behind a girlfriend named Carrie. Wayne was furious. He demanded to know who else from the No Surrender crew had brought a gun to the church meeting. As he started frisking Boxer Mouchedre, his prison pal Frank Mather found a gym bag from behind the couch that had a sawed-off lever-action rifle. No one owned up to bringing it. Satisfied that none of the No Surrender crew had firearms, Wayne Callestine then got to business. He confined them in the barn, warning them that there were more guys on the roof they couldn't see who wouldn't hesitate to shoot. He confiscated their keys, cell phones, identification, and other personal items. But once again, he stalled on the required official act of pulling their patches. Wayne drank heavily, ranted, and broke out into a rendition of the German national anthem. His behavior became more and more bizarre. He didn't seem to have a clear plan about what was happening, but he never really did. And the No Surrender crew had a few hardened criminals, but they were mostly with the club for socializing and camaraderie, so didn't react with the violence that might be expected of a one percenter. And they were in shock. They continued to sit and wait as Wayne Callestine pointed at Chopper Raposo's body and ordered little Mikey Trotter to roll it into a rug. Jamie Goldberg Flans went to help little Mikey out, but Wayne did not like that. He physically assaulted Goldberg and accused him of being a police informant. Pressing the muzzle of his firearm against Goldberg's head, Wayne told him, quote, "I'm going to do you last because you're a fucking Jew." There was a tense few seconds as Goldberg braced himself. Then Wayne relaxed and said, "Just kidding." A few seconds later, he did it again, pressing the muzzle, then releasing it. All fun and games to him, but Jamie Goldberg Flans was terrified. Boxer Mushedre tried to defuse the situation, calmly telling Wayne that Goldberg was not a police informant. But Wayne didn't care. He was driven by his hatred to the detriment of logic or reason. No one knew it at the time, but there actually was a police informant in the room. It wasn't Jamie Goldberg Flans. Meanwhile, No Surrender crew member George Crash Kriarakis had been reciting a Greek prayer as he clutched his abdomen. He couldn't stop shivering. Marcelo Aravina of the Winnipeg crew passed him a blanket. They were on opposing sides, but human after all. Crash spoke about how much he loved Diane, his wife of less than a year. Frank Bam Bam Solano started praying too. Wayne Callestine mocked them all for it. But apparently, Wayne still felt a tinge of loyalty towards Boxer, or at least a slight obligation to mirror Boxer's own loyalty in some way. Wayne made him an offer. If Boxer left the No Surrender crew and crossed the floor, they would spare his life. But Boxer was loyal to a fault. He said, "Do me now. I want to go out like a man." Wayne dismissed him. He walked outside and returned with a pair of shackles, which he proceeded to put on Boxer just to be safe. Wayne told him it wasn't because he didn't trust him. Then he grinned, quote, "It's just that I don't trust you." Wayne started singing the German anthem again and grabbed George Pony Jessam, the tow truck driver in his 50s with terminal cancer. He beat the man with the butt of his rifle, apologized for it, then dragged Pony outside. All this time, Michael Taz Sandham had been playing second fiddle to Wayne Callestine, but when Wayne left with Pony, Michael found some courage and started ranting to the other No Surrender crew members in his, quote, "squeaky little voice." It was about that membership dues thing again. He insisted he'd been sending money orders to pay the Winnipeg dues and suggested Treasurer Chopper Raposo had not been forwarding that money over to the US like he was supposed to. Of course, Chopper was no longer alive to defend himself. Wayne returned to the barn with George Pony Jessam. The reason he'd taken him outside was to order him to move Chopper Raposo's silver Volkswagen Golf. Chopper's body, wrapped in the carpet, was carried out to the car. It was well after midnight now, and this had been going on for almost 2 hours. One of the cell phones belonging to the No Surrender crew started ringing from the top of the fridge. It belonged to John Boxer Mouchedre, and it wasn't the first time his phone had been ringing that evening. Wayne told him he could answer it, but cautioned him not to say anything stupid. Boxer wouldn't have anyway. He calmly answered the phone. It was his fiancée Nina checking in. They were still planning a road trip to Chatham that weekend, and they planned to leave as soon as Boxer got home from the farm. She wanted to know the ETA. They had a short conversation, and he asked how their baby was. He told Nina he loved her, and he'd see them both in a couple of hours. The OPP surveillance officers were still parked a short distance from the farm, and they didn't hear any of the gunfire. They'd been waiting there for about 2 hours and thought nothing of note was happening. It had been a long, long day. They withdrew from the scene and rated the day a success. Back inside the barn, Wayne Callestine pointed his rifle at his old friend and former mentee, Boxer Mouchedre. Author Peter Edwards would write, quote, "Mouchedre walked outside with his longtime friend, with his head held high and his cherished one percenter beliefs untarnished by the venality and cowardice that surrounded him." They walked over to the same silver Volkswagen that had Chopper's carpet-covered body lying across the back seat. It was now hooked up to the tow truck owned by George Pony Jessam. Wayne Callestine ordered Boxer to get into the car. Boxer refused. He said he knew he was going to get 2 bullets to the back of the head. Wayne told him he wasn't going to shoot him and ordered him to sit in the front passenger seat. Boxer did as instructed. Then he looked up at Wayne and started to laugh. Wayne couldn't take it. He shot his old friend and mentee twice in the head and once in the lower torso. Giovanni John Mouchedre was dead, aged 48. He left behind his fiancée and new baby daughter, as well as 5 older children from his first 2 marriages. Back inside the barn, George Crash Kriarakis heard the shots. Everyone did. He was beside himself and still fading in the wake of his stomach wound. Wayne Callestine returned and kicked Frank Bam Bam Salerno in the head and swore at him, just because. Wayne told Crash it was time to go. Crash pulled himself up and limped outside, flanked by Wayne and his red-haired prison friend, Frank Mather. Maybe they were finally going to the hospital. But when they got out to Chopper's Volkswagen Golf, Crash would have seen that they weren't. He was ordered to get into the driver's seat, next to where Boxer's dead body was in the passenger seat. Wayne shot George Crash Kriarakis 6 more times in the head, face, and upper body. The 28-year-old newlywed died, leaving behind his wife, Diane. Next was George Pony Jessam, who was ordered to get into the back seat of his own tow truck. Pony was already dying of terminal cancer. He'd only joined the Bandidos for support and friendship in his dying days. He never would have expected that he would end up dying at their hands instead. Wayne Callestine shot the 52-year-old twice in the head and once in the chest. Since the initial shootout that left Chopper dead, Michael Taz Sandham hadn't been doing that much except standing around trying to look menacing as Wayne Callestine took over. And Wayne now started ranting about how he was the only one willing to do the dirty work. He'd already killed three members of the No Surrender crew, and he wasn't done yet. Wayne returned to the barn and ordered Big Paulie to move. The big guy was extremely stressed and struggling to catch his breath as he was led out of the barn, limping. Goldberg's silver Infiniti SUV was now parked outside with its rear hatch open. Wayne ordered Big Paulie to lie down in it. He did as he was told. Wayne shot him twice in the head. Paul Big Paulie Sinopoli passed away, age 30. He would have lived had Toronto President Frank Bam Bam Salerno allowed him to stay home that day. It was Bam Bam's turn next. Wayne Callestine seemed to be enjoying this process and was almost gleeful about it as he marched the next victim outside. Frank Bam Bam Salerno stretched out his hand to shake hands with the rivals he knew were about to kill him. Bam Bam asked them for two favours, that they would make sure his baby son was taken care of and make sure his family was told where his body would be. Bam Bam had already been grazed by one bullet to the leg. Seconds later, he was shot another 8 times in the nose, cheek, ear, hand, thigh, and lower leg. Frank Bam Bam Salerno passed away, aged 43. He left behind his wife Stephanie and new baby son. Back in the barn, little Mikey Trotter and Jamie Goldberg Flans had been on their hands and knees cleaning up the blood from the first eruption of gunfire that left Chopper Raposo dead. It was on Wayne Callestine's orders and they solemnly obeyed, as all of their clubmates had been marched out one by one. And now they were the only two members of the No Surrender crew left. Little Mikey Trotter had a young family and worked for a trailer rental company in the Greater Toronto area. Months earlier, he'd been promoted from salesperson to manager and had been talking about leaving the Bandidos to focus on his legitimate career. But now it was too late. Wayne ordered little Mikey out of the barn and marched him over to Goldberg's Infiniti SUV. It already had two bodies inside. Bam Bam was in the back passenger seat and Big Paulie was lying in the rear hatch. Wayne ordered little Mikey to get into the front passenger seat, raised his rifle and shot him twice in the head and once in the chest. Michael Little Mikey Trotter passed away, age 31. He left behind a wife and two young children. Jamie Goldberg Flans was the only one left. The entire time he'd been cleaning up, he spoke about how much he loved his two young children. But Wayne Callestine had made good on his hateful promise to save Goldberg for last because he was Jewish. He wanted him to suffer. Outside the barn, Goldberg was ordered to get into the back seat of the dark grey Pontiac Grand Prix, a family sedan that little Mikey Trotter had purchased only a couple of weeks earlier. Goldberg sat next to a child's car seat, another child who would never see their father again. Michael Taz Sandem had decided he was going to do this one, first and last. He squeezed the trigger and shot Goldberg through the cheek. It didn't kill him. And then Michael Sandem froze. He claimed the gun was jammed, but Dwight Mushy took it from his hand and finished the job, shooting 37-year-old Jamie Goldberg Flans again in the head. With that, the No Surrender crew was done. Wayne Callestine, Frank Mather, and the Winnipeg crew were all unharmed. They had 8 bodies to get off Wayne Callestine's property and fast. It was still dark outside, but the sun would be rising soon. Wayne ordered Frank to get behind the wheel of Goldberg's Infiniti SUV with the bodies of little Mikey and Bam Bam. Big Paulie lay lifeless in the rear hatch, but his body was so large they couldn't shut the door. Moving it was out of the question. They had to leave the hatch partially open. Dwight Mushy drove the Pontiac Grand Prix family sedan with Goldberg's body in the back, and Curtis Davidson drove the green Silverado tow truck with Pony's body in the back seat. Hooked up to the tow truck was the silver Volkswagen. Crash's body was in the driver's seat, slumped over the steering wheel. Boxer sat lifeless in the passenger seat beside him, and Chopper's body was lying on the back seat, a virtual ghost ship on wheels. Michael Taz Sandham followed them in his own car so he could drive them back to the farm where Wayne Callestine would be waiting for them. The plan was to drive almost an hour and a half northeast on the highway to the Twin Cities of Kitchener-Waterloo, where the Hells Angels were known to have a strong presence. They would dump the cars around there somewhere, figuring the police would assume the Hells Angels were behind it, and it would go unsolved because of a lack of evidence. Some local residents were up early and noticed the vehicles driving past. The fact that the tow truck had its flashing lights on drew attention, but also deflected it. Just an early morning collision. It probably didn't occur to those residents that it might actually be outlaw bikers transporting the bodies of the 8 clubmates they had just slaughtered in what would be named one of the largest massacres in Canadian history.
Seit mehr als 155 Jahren begleitet die Commerzbank Kundinnen und Kunden bei wichtigen finanziellen Entscheidungen. Ob sie ihr Unternehmen weiterentwickeln, ihr Vermögen strukturieren oder ihre finanzielle Zukunft planen. Gemeinsam machen wir aus ihren Ideen, Plänen und Anliegen echte Erfolgsgeschichten. Erfolg, der auf unserer langjährigen Expertise und einer vertrauensvollen Partnerschaft basiert. Erfolgsgeschichten beginnen bei der Commerzbank. Wann sprechen wir über Ihre? Mehr Infos unter commerzbank.de/erfolgsgeschichten.
Hi, this is Sherelle Dorsey from TED Tech, and this episode is brought to you by Solidigm. The world runs on data, and data relies on storage. But most businesses rarely think about how crucial that storage really is. The truth is, it's no longer just a commodity. With new demands and constraints, especially from AI, the old ways of managing data are holding innovation back. Solid-state storage from Solidigm is changing that. It helps reduce energy use, shrink physical footprints, and accelerate data at the edge, unlocking more from your AI infrastructure. Learn more at whatsthestateofyourstorage.com.
It didn't take long for dairy farmer Russ to discover the 4 random vehicles that had appeared overnight on his property near Shedden. The Ontario Provincial Police arrived shortly after 8 a.m. and launched a large-scale investigation, with helicopters surveying the area from above. A few hours later, the 4 vehicles were transported to headquarters in a covered truck, with the 8 bodies still inside. Investigators searched each vehicle for evidence of what might have happened and why. One of the cars was a family sedan, with a man's body slumped in the back against a car seat. There were toys scattered on the floor of the car, along with letters from a Toronto school board. This was just sad. But there were some items of note. A leather cut-off vest with a Bandidos patch, a silver Bandidos ring, and spent ammunition. There was also a printout of that smug email that Chopper Raposo had received from Michael Taz Sandham.
"I'm not available. Stop calling the brothers' homes and families."
The police knew that Wayne Callestine, known local Bandidos member, lived only about 10 kilometres from the village of Shedden where those vehicles were abandoned. What they didn't know was whether Wayne was a survivor of the massacre or one of the perpetrators. If the 56-year-old was involved, it was not the smartest move to leave those cars, that evidence, so close to where he lived. But on the other hand, Wayne Callestine wasn't exactly known to be strategic or rational. At about 1 p.m. that same day, the OPP and paramilitary police sealed off a 15-kilometre radius around Wayne Callestine's farm as they waited for a search warrant. The news of the discovery had already started to spread in the local area and to the media. Over the next few hours, they watched as two men and a woman went from the barn to the house and back again, carrying heavy buckets. It appeared to be a cleanup of some sort. So if Wayne Callestine's plan was for the four vehicles to be driven about 130 kilometres up the highway and dumped near Kitchener-Waterloo, how did they end up so close to his farm? The answer was simple lack of planning. Shortly after they got on the highway, the gas light suddenly came on in the Infiniti SUV. Frank Mather was driving the car. Wayne's red-haired prison pal with the swastika tattoo was not a member of the Bandidos. He had just agreed to help Wayne in exchange for a place to stay. And now he'd found himself driving the first car in a procession to transport the bodies of eight dead Bandidos away from a crime scene. He had a decision to make. They'd only been on the road for about 10 minutes. They weren't going to make it to Kitchener-Waterloo. And he certainly could not stop and get gas on the way, not with the bodies of two dead bikers in the car and a 400-pound body lying in the rear, preventing the hatch from closing properly. Frank made the split-second decision to pull off the highway, and the others followed suit. That's how they ended up near the tiny hamlet of Shedden. Frank Mather drove past a series of fields until they got to a fairly isolated wooded section. He pulled the Infiniti onto a field, and the others pulled up further along the dirt road. Michael Sandham had been following them in his own car, and they jumped in and took off for the much shorter than expected drive back to the farm. Dawn was just about to break. Wayne Callestine was surprised to see them back so soon. The original plan would have resulted in a 3-hour road trip, but they were back in less than half that time. They explained to Wayne what had happened. Obviously, this wasn't ideal. The cars were abandoned only about 10 minutes' drive away from Wayne's rural farm. There goes the plan to implicate the Hell's Angels. All they could do now was clean up and dispose of as much evidence as they could. Everyone was ordered to take off their clothes and shoes and carry them out to the fire pit for burning. Shortly after that, it was time for the Winnipeg crew to get out of there. Brett Gardner volunteered to stay behind at the farm and help Wayne Callestine and Frank Mather with the cleanup. The other four, Michael Taz Sandham, Dwight Mushy, Curtis Davidson and Marcelo Aravina, left for the long drive back to Winnipeg. They would be seen on a Walmart camera just north of Toronto buying Head & Shoulders shampoo. Apparently, it cleared away gun residue. At about 8 a.m, right as the police arrived at the scene of the four abandoned vehicles spaced out along the dirt road, Wayne Callestine's phone started ringing at the farm. It was Boxer Mouchedre's fiancée, Nina. She'd stayed up all night waiting for him to return to the farm so they could get going on their own road trip to scope out somewhere to live in Chatham. When Boxer didn't answer his phone, she started calling around other members of the No Surrender crew. No one answered. Wayne Callestine was her last resort. He told Nina that Boxer had already left the farm. That was technically true, but he was definitely not on his way back to Toronto. Frank Bam Bam Salerno's wife, Stephanie, had also been calling his cell phone during the early morning hours when she woke up to feed their baby. It wasn't overly unusual for Bam Bam not to pick up. Stephanie thought he was just busy at work washing trucks. Within a few hours, she would know that something was wrong. Wayne Callestine, Frank Mather, and Winnipeg prospect Brett Gardner continued to clean and dispose of the evidence, including all the clothes and shoes, the personal belongings of the No Surrender crew, and blood-soaked furniture. They dragged it all out to the fire pit. They packed all the firearms away and gathered the spent shells. That afternoon, a friend of Wayne's showed up unexpectedly. Eric Neeson had known Wayne for about 2 years and was an official supporter of the Bandidos. He often visited the farm, and that day was just another visit. When he drove up with his common-law wife, Kerry, and some beers, he noticed a number of marked and unmarked police vehicles parked along the road. They went in anyway and soon realised that it was probably related to the news they'd been hearing all over the radio, the discovery of 8 bodies in abandoned vehicles near Shedden. Wayne Callestine was glad to see them. He told them he needed help and asked them to lie to the police if asked. For some reason, this couple readily agreed to help Wayne try and get away with a serious crime they personally had nothing to do with. They were to say they first arrived at the farm the night before to party with Wayne and the others, and that nothing else of note happened. The phone in Wayne's farmhouse was ringing constantly as journalists and others called to figure out if Wayne was one of the victims or one of the killers. And he seemed to be enjoying toying with them, telling a reporter, quote,
"Hang on for a sec. Am I alive? Geez, I've been with a house full of people in here for the last 2 days. I think I'm alive, but I'll have to check that out."
Boxer Mushedre's younger brother Joe also called the farm. He said he knew that Boxer was dead, but wanted to know if Wayne knew anything about it. Wayne offered his condolences, but not much else. Then, Louise Chopper Raposo's girlfriend phoned in a panic. She'd seen his Volkswagen on a breaking news report and wanted to know if Chopper was dead. Wayne would not give her an answer. In part 3, Wayne Callestine and Michael Sandham continue to try and get away with the massacre, along with their associates. Now that they've successfully pulled the patches of the No Surrender crew, they are also eyeing the ultimate prize, being appointed the national president of the Canadian Bandidos. But US headquarters has other ideas, and none of them have any idea that a confidential police informant has been among them all along. Part 3 is available to all in a week. This series has been primarily pieced together from multiple court documents and the news archives, most notably the reporting of Jane Sims for the London Free Press, Timothy Appleby for the Globe and Mail, and Peter Edwards for the Toronto Star, as well as his 2010 book, The Bandido Massacre. For the full list of resources and anything else you want to know about the podcast, visit canadiantruecrime.ca and follow us on the Canadian True Crime Facebook and Instagram pages to see photos and clippings. Canadian True Crime donates monthly to those facing injustice. This month, we have donated to the Canadian Resource Centre for Victims of Crime, who offer support, research and education to survivors, victims and their families. You can learn more at crcvc.ca. Audio editing was by Crosby Audio, and Eric Crosby voiced the disclaimer. Our senior producer is Lindsay Eldridge. Carol Weinberg is our script consultant. Research, writing, narration and sound design was by me, and the theme songs were composed by We Talk of Dreams. I'll be back soon with another Canadian true crime episode. See you then.
Hi, this is Sherelle Dorsey from TED Tech, and this episode is brought to you by Solidigm. The world runs on data, and data relies on storage. But most businesses rarely think about how crucial that storage really is. The truth is, it's no longer just a commodity. With new demands and constraints, especially from AI, the old ways of managing data are holding innovation back. Solid-state storage from Solidigm is changing that. It helps reduce energy use, shrink physical footprints, and accelerate data at the edge, unlocking more from your AI infrastructure. Learn more at whatsthestateofyourstorage.com.
In a world of growing division, understanding becomes our path forward. Immerse yourself in Critical Currents, the podcast series that explores pivotal debates and cultural movements shaping democracies today. Brought to you by the Thomas Mann House Los Angeles, the Wendham Museum, and DubLab Radio, with guests such as author Rosecrans Baldwin, philosopher Susan Neiman, or interviewer Paul Holdengraber. Start listening now wherever you get your podcasts.